Museum's groundbreaking in June 2017. While there are more than 30 Olympic museums around the world, attempts to establish a major one in the United States had never materialized. The changes this year, when the first full-fledged Olympic and Paralympic museum in the United States opens in Colorado Springs, well, in time to celebrate on home soil during the rescheduled to 2021 Tokyo 2020 Summer Games, or any time at all. Colorado's second city is, after all, Olympic City, USA, home of both the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee and the flagship U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Training Center. It's a logical place to honor the ideals and document the history of the Olympic and Paralympic movements, and to share the impressive and inspiring stories of the nearly 13,000 U.S. Olympic and Paralympic athletes who have competed for Team USA since 1896. The 60,000 square foot museum features 13 galleries, several special events areas, a 145-seat theater, and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Hall of Fame, which showcases inducted athletes, teams, coaches, and special contributors to the movements. As part of the immersive storytelling and programming, the museum displays a considerable and growing collection of artifacts ranging from the monumental to the mundane, from Bonnie Blair's speed skates to Shannon Miller's scrunchie. Athletes are constantly sending us artifacts and memorabilia from their games experience, says Director of Marketing and Communications Tommy Shield. Nearly every day we get to work, it feels like Christmas. One of the best things on view is the Miracle on Ice scoreboard from the hockey match at the 1980 Lake Placid Olympic Winter Games that memorably saw the young underdog U.S. team, coached by Herb Brooks, come from behind to defeat the monolithic Soviets and ultimately take the gold. Vying with the scoreboard for most impactful and evocative is the impressive collection of Olympic torches, including one like the torch memorably carried by Muhammad Ali, who lit the Olympic cauldron during the opening ceremony at the 1996 Games in Atlanta. The design and construction team, led by the award-winning New York architecture firm Diller Scofido plus Renfro, created a sustainable and accessible complex, the concept of which seems to take for its inspiration the physical feats of athletes, twisting and stretching centrifugally around the atrium space. You'll want to experience it for yourself, but Diller Scofidio and Renfro has supplied a nice description on its website. Visitors ascend from the ground-level atrium to the top of the building quickly and gradually spiral down through a sequence of loft galleries, moving back and forth from the introspective atrium to the building's perimeter and views to the city and the mountains. The museum and the landscape are designed to form a new public plaza, nestling a distant view of Pikes Peak and an intersecting axis bridging downtown across the train tracks to the America the Beautiful Park to the west. In keeping with the Olympic and Paralympic ideals, the museum strives to deliver a shared experience for all visitors. Sports have the power to unite, Shield says, and that's what the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum has the ability to do. Dramatic duo. Diane Lane and Kevin Costner set out on a dangerous western journey in the gripping new thriller Let Him Go by Joe Layden. Call Let Him Go a slow burn thriller and you won't be far off the mark. Indeed, the fuse is lit as early as the opening scenes, during which even the commonplace activities of a daily routine feel infused with a sense of unease, if not dread. George, Kevin Costner, and Margaret Blackledge, Diane Lane, appear at ease with each other in the kitchen of their 1950s Montana farmhouse, tending to morning chores. But there is unmistakable tension between Margaret and Lorna, Kaylee Carter, her daughter-in-law, whom she criticizes for being insufficiently attentive to her infant son, Margaret's grandson. And while their son James, Ryan Bruce, seems confident and competent as he sets out on a ride around their spread, Margaret and George immediately fear the worst when his horse returns without him. Sure enough, when George rides out to find him, he finds his son dead, the result of a tragic accident. Flash forward 3 years or so, Lorna marries Donnie Waboy, Will Britton, a seemingly rootless fellow who obviously doesn't impress George and Margaret. Still, the Blackledges do their best to remain on good terms with the younger couple, if only for the sake of their grandson. Even when Margaret sees Donnie mistreating little Jimmy, played alternately by Bram and Otto Hornig, and striking Lorna, she says nothing to George, who, not incidentally, just happens to be a retired sheriff. But then comes the day when Donnie, Lorna, and Jimmy move out of their apartment without alerting the Blackledges and head off to points unknown. At first, George responds with typical stoicism. "Sometimes that's all life is, Margaret, a list of what we've lost." But Margaret won't be appeased so easily. One way or another, with George's help or not, she will pursue the younger couple and reunite with her grandson. Keep this in mind. All of what you've just read is simply the setup for Let Him Go, a gripping drama that slowly, steadily builds suspense as the Blackledges track their grandson to an off-the-grid household in the Dakotas that is ruled with a whim of iron by Blanche Weeboy, Leslie Manville, a fiercely insular matriarch with implacable ideas about family ties, and a group of offspring ready and eager to do her bidding. After a certain point in the film, the audience can't help worrying that something terrible may happen at any moment, unless something worse happens first. When bad things ultimately do happen, they come as shocks, but not surprises. Based on an acclaimed novel by Larry Watson, Let Him Go is a striking change of pace for writer-director Thomas Bishuda, whose previous credits include Big Eden, 2000, a sweet-natured romantic comedy about a gay New York artist, Ari Gross, who finds his neighbors are surprisingly supportive when he returns to his small Montana hometown, and The Family Stone, 2005, a well-received dramedy in which an uptight Manhattan executive, Sarah Jessica Parker, is thrown out of her comfort zone by the rambunctiously bohemian parents, Diane Keaton and Craig T. Nelson, and family of her fiancé, Dermot Mulroney. More important, it's also a showcase for another exceptional performance by the formidably versatile Diane Lane, whose credits range from teenage roles opposite Laurence Olivier, A Little Romance, Burt Lancaster, Cattle Annie and Little Britches, and Kenny Rogers, Six-Pack, to demanding adult parts in such films and dramas as Unfaithful, Under the Tuscan Sun, Secretariat, and, of course, the epic miniseries Lonesome Dove. We caught up with Lane by phone during the pandemic lockdown to talk about her compelling performance as a woman driven to extremes to save her grandson in Let Him Go. Here are some highlights from our conversation. Whenever an actor plays a role as emotionally demanding as Margaret Blackledge, they must really have a lot of trust in their director, so they'll know they're in safe hands as they take risks. How did Thomas Prosciutto earn your trust? Great question. In this case, I could see evidence of emotional intelligence in his previous work. I thought, oh wow, he's got a tremendous amount of heart, and I bet he's going to bring that to whatever story appeals to him next. I feel like he is a wonderful student of humaneness. And when we met, I could see he's so well-spoken and he's so well-read. I have had experiences in the past where I just adore a director in terms of being in their presence. But then when you're working under them, a whole other character comes out on the film set. Once they don the leadership cap, for some reason, other elements of their personality come out. But I will say that Tom remained like a stoic angel, guarding the priorities of our story getting on film. You were working on a tight schedule and a limited budget. Did that place additional pressure on you during production? Every experience has its obstacle course. In hindsight, it's always a miracle that a film gets made. Sometimes daily, it's a miracle. I mean, while we were filming up in Calgary, the weather changed every 30 minutes or so, and we had a lot of outdoor stuff to film. That's true for Texas as well, and when we did Lonesome Dove there, we had a lot of the same problems. But Tom made it easier because he's somebody that, well, George C. Wolfe, who I worked with on Nights in Rodanthe, 2008, was another director that I felt this way about. I would serve coffee on the set just to be near them. I mean, they have such a beneficent aura about them and an inclusiveness. And that's so important on a film. When you accomplish both leadership and inclusion, it's not always the case. So it was just a wonderful experience. Whatever the fate of the movie, it was just a gift to do it. You and Kevin Costner developed such a wonderful chemistry together that it's easy to believe you as a long married couple with decades of shared experiences. There are many examples of this throughout Let Him Go, but there's an especially funny and telling scene where he buys a small bottle of whiskey and he immediately indicates he doesn't want to be nagged about it. And while Margaret is wise enough not to nag, it's crystal clear that she disapproves. Well, sometimes you don't have to be the one to say anything. As we depict in our scene, there's clearly a historical reference to a drinking issue, and he just says he appreciates not getting a lecture. I suppose that's progress for a couple that's been dealing with each other and their secrets over several decades. For her, she doesn't have to say a word. He knows exactly what she would be saying. That's the benefit of a long-term relationship. You can just look at each other and pretty much know how the other one feels about most things. There is a quiet intimacy that long-term relationships benefit from. As far as chemistry goes, I know that's a term that is bandied about a lot, but it was definitely there between me and Kevin. We had the pleasure of being friends from Man of Steel in 2013, and I just knew he was going to have to come back for Batman and Dawn of Justice, 2016, even though his character had passed into the great beyond. But I'm happy to hear you say you noticed the chemistry here. I know I felt it while we were filming. But it's funny, because sometimes you can feel it and it won't be conveyed to the camera. It's the strangest phenomenon I've ever experienced. I mean, it's like sometimes when you're doing a love scene, you feel like you're giving so much and you're connected and sharing and letting the camera in, but then you see it on film and it doesn't convey. And then other times, it feels like cardboard while you're doing it, and the sparks are flying on the screen. So there's still a mysterious element that is intangible and not under the actor's control, believe it or not. But still, even though the two of you are evenly matched here, you could make an argument that you are the movie's protagonist. George reluctantly goes along with you. Reluctantly, that is, probably because he's a retired lawman, and he knows how family squabbles like this can turn out. And he comes through when the chips are down. Yet Margaret is the one who truly drives the story, and her husband, with her obsession, for better or worse. Maybe. But categorizing someone as a protagonist is like trying to find the first domino in the line. Here you have the dance of a husband trying to bring peace to his wife's heart. I mean, one person in a relationship can comprehend loss and be able to go forward in life with a modicum of peace, whereas the other person cannot achieve peace with that loss. I mean, clearly, she's projected onto the grandchild the loss of her son. So the grandchild embodies a connection to her dead son, and rightfully so. But I also feel that the generosity of heart that Kevin possesses in himself makes him perfect for his character because of the level of sacrifice, the level of commitment George has. You do quite a bit of writing in Let Him Go, which you haven't done in many other films. In fact, except for Cattle Annie and Little Britches and Lonesome Dove, which were westerns, we haven't seen you in the saddle much at all. That's true, and it's always an interesting situation because whenever you have an actor on a horse, you have to insure them for the entire value of the project. I mean, they could continue filming if, God forbid, the director became unwell or something. But if one of your actors has an accident and can't film, you've really screwed the pooch. So you really have to practice, because by insurance company standards, anything you do with a horse, anytime you ride a horse, is considered a stunt. They figure that's a lot of power underneath your leading lady. They consider just being near a horse a stunt in terms of insurance. In fact, sometimes you practice what you're going to be doing in the film, and then you get to the set and they say, "Oh, no, actually, we're not going to let you run on the horse." And you're like, "What do you mean? I'm all polished and proud, and I can jump off the saddle and do what's asked of me." It's disappointing, but you realize it's a very rare circumstance where an actor is allowed to do very much on a horse. And it's funny. What constitutes a stunt on a set is not necessarily what you imagine it to be. But you manage to ride tall here. You know, if you're going to shoot a film in Calgary, you can be 80% sure there are horses involved in the story. And everybody giggles, and it's sweet, and it's just the way it is, because the landscape and the beauty around that area is still available in its natural form to film. In this case, I was happy to see that the lady who would really do the riding in the wide shots was Jerry Deuce. My hat is off to her for the rest of my days. I mean, she's just an epic stunt rider. I think she was the first woman to get into the Cowboy Hall of Fame, and she teaches the craft that she practices. She became friends with me because she was the one who would practice riding with me. I had such a ball knowing what she was capable of. I mean, it was like taking a Ferrari and going around the block with her, because she's capable of so much. It's so funny. I would get to do something that I'd practiced, but I would only get to do it twice on camera. And I'd be like, "Really? It was like 2 times, 20 seconds. That's all I get?" But it's on film forever. If it were up to me, I'd still be there doing it, because I love horses so much. And I was lucky here to have a good relationship with my horse. I call it a fringe benefit. It was better than riding side saddle, and much better than in Lonesome Dove, where I was in a corset and a petticoat. Or on Cattle Annie and Little Britches. There, I was the third person on the horse with Amanda Plummer and John Savage. I was the sucker who was stuck on the withers. Let me tell you, it's no fun to ride in 100 degrees in Mexico down a mountain on a horse's withers. You never forget that. Questions and Answers with Kevin Costner. The Oscar winner holds forth about playing a wary but supportive retired sheriff in Let Him Go. More often than not, a lot more often, really, Kevin Costner effortlessly assumes the take-charge role in any film or TV scenario. Whether he's mentoring an undisciplined baseball rookie in Bull Durham, or proving himself worthy of acceptance as a fellow warrior by a Sioux tribe, Dances with Wolves, or authoritatively exerting mastery of his land and legacy as a modern-day Montana cattle rancher, Yellowstone. There's rarely any doubt about who's at the wheel when it comes to driving the plot. But in Let Him Go, the suspenseful drama written and directed by Thomas Bershuda and based on the novel by Larry Watson, Costner is less a resolutely decisive leader than a reluctantly led partner. Specifically, he plays George Blackledge, a retired sheriff turned rancher in 1950s Montana, who joins Margaret, Diane Lane, his strong-willed wife, on a perilous journey to the Dakotas to retrieve their young grandson, who has been spirited away by their late son's widow and her new husband, and taken with them to the homestead of the husband's notoriously intimidating kinfolk. "It's a real dilemma for me as George," Costner told CNI during a recent interview, "because I see what could be the outcome of her decision to go after them. And it scares me because I love my wife too much to let her be in harm's way alone. But I know there's enough danger there to take us all down." Also covered in our conversation, what was there that attracted you to Let Him Go? I think it was that early on, I saw this as a thing where you realize that sometimes you have to go down this path with someone you love so much to do something that they're compelled to do, and you know it's wrong. Everything in your body is saying it's wrong. Everything in your mind, your experience, is saying this is wrong. You understand emotionally why she's doing it, but at the end, the logic of human behavior is abandoned. I mean, she doesn't feel she's being irrational. She's just being driven by love. Her grandson, this young life, is not going to be in the right hands. And there's me sitting on the other side saying, sometimes being right doesn't matter. And then it ends up destroying their life. I think sometimes men do end up following their women. If women aren't careful, they can drag their men into various serious things. It may not be immediately apparent while you're immersed in the movie, but wouldn't you agree that when you replay it in your mind afterwards, you might see that Margaret has a lot in common with Blanche, the head of the family that gains control of your grandchild? Their wills, their desires, their sense of protectiveness on purpose or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, they could be put in the same bucket, but they're separated wildly by their ethics and morals. There's no indication that George is or ever has been a weak man. Indeed, he's a retired sheriff, so he's likely no stranger to violence or dangerous situations. And that probably makes him even more aware of the risk he and Margaret are taking when they try to retrieve their grandchild. There's not any guy who wouldn't know this is a bad situation. And yet, she doesn't know or want to know what she's doing. She's going to get her man into a fight with people that fight to the death. That's what she's doing. It's like the first time I watched Moby Dick. I was young, and that movie scared me. And I didn't know why it scared me. And then somebody said the word to me, "This guy was obsessed." And I said, "What's obsession?" And I was told it's a willingness to take everybody down because of your own position. Ahab wanted that whale so badly that he put his crew in this position. He didn't care anymore. I'm not saying that Margaret doesn't care anymore, but she's obsessed. I think that's going to spur a little bit of discussion for men and women who watch. Maybe while they're driving home, or if they don't see it in a theater, maybe in their living room. Wherever they are, they'll go, "Didn't she see? He knew right away where this was going, where it could go. Why didn't she see?" You and Diane Lane were well matched and thoroughly persuasive as Superman's adoptive parents, Jonathan and Martha Kent in Man of Steel. But you're even more compelling together here because the threat is more realistic and the mortal stakes are much higher. Did you have much rehearsal time to work out backstories for your characters? Oh, yes. She's a very good rehearsal partner, and she's a really good partner on the set, too. She's just very supportive of other people, and she's protective of the process. She knows how to stand up for herself, and she knows that there's people standing up with her. And she loves to act. She's one of our great actresses. There's no question about it. She is one of five in the world. And yet, to a large degree, she's underrated. It's almost as though every few years people have to rediscover how great she is all over again. Well, that's because she takes on roles and assimilates into them, and that forces people to re-examine her. She's not a person who is built to repeat herself. She understands that we all have to do that to a certain extent, but she is really gifted, and she's still a romantic leading woman. She can play a grandma, but she doesn't need to. What I mean is, she can play the grandma in one film, but she still can be a romantic woman in another screenplay. She can take on that persona, too. That's not easy. She's just great. And better still, as this movie proves, she can ride a horse. Yeah, she got up there and did it. James and the Giant Collection. Curator of art, Emily Capes, takes CNI on a special tour of the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art. There's a love story behind the James Museum. Love of a couple of each other. Love of skiing in Colorado and of shopping for art as travel mementos. Love of Western and Native American art and artists. And love of giving back to a community. The James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art opened in the heart of downtown St. Petersburg, Florida, just blocks from the city's waterfront park in April 2018. But the beginnings of the collection go back decades to the college days of founders Tom and Mary James. Tom James is the son of Bob James, who founded Raymond James Financial in 1964 in St. Petersburg, says curator of art Emily Capes, who began managing the corporate collection in 2005. Tom grew up here, then went off to Harvard, where he met his now wife, Mary, while she was attending nearby Wellesley. While dating in college, they started collecting art, going to local art fairs, or, when traveling, picking up pieces that spoke to them. Mary had grown up in Michigan and was an accomplished skier. Tom had grown up in Florida and wasn't a skier. He was a workaholic in the early days of the firm, but she got him to vacation in Colorado, where the couple began buying art to remember their trips. Tom quickly became an avid skier as well. On one particular vacation, on a day when the weather wasn't good for skiing, Tom decided to hit one of the Western art galleries in town. He'd grown up watching Westerns and playing cowboys and Indians, and in the galleries he discovered an affinity for Western, Native, and wildlife art. He really connected with it, and with the artists themselves, Capes says. As their art collection continued to grow organically, over time it became more and more focused on Western and wildlife art. With success came a desire to give back. when the burgeoning collection outgrew Raymond James Financial's corporate headquarters, where educational programs and art tours had become well known, plans for a museum began to take shape. They wanted to have the museum where they were, where the collection was, and where their community was, Capes says. Tom still works full-time as the firm's chairman emeritus, though he and Mary make time for travel. The couple still travels to Colorado, as well as Arizona and New Mexico, and they enjoy finding art and meeting artists on every adventure. They share their love of the West and the East at the St. Petersburg Museum that bears their name. Mary and Tom continue to select every piece, and whenever they can, meet the artists. They love getting to know the artists and supporting living artists, Capes says. In the collection, you'll see dozens of works by artists like the Jameses have had as a personal relationship with, such as John Coleman, Dave McCreary, and Dan Naminga. Their museum is housed in a former department store building that was reimagined by Florida-based architect Jan Weymouth, who also designed St. Pete's Salvador Dali Museum. It's truly a dynamic transformation, Capes says. The lobby's design is inspired by an arroyo. The first floor has nearly 28-foot-high walls of sandstone, 31,000 square feet of sandstone tiles. Every tile of the two-story high walls was specifically numbered and placed and reviewed according to the pattern and color of the stones. The horizontal striations really make it look like a canyon. Visitors feel they've been transported to the West. Capes has placed a John Coleman piece in front of a waterfall at the end of the museum's arroyo, setting the tone for the visitor's artistic journey through the West and providing a natural first stop on her tour of a dozen key pieces in the collection. That immersive experience continues with a switchback, a set of stairs that climb from the canyon to the second floor. The first pieces I placed were landscapes that introduced visitors to the grand and varied vistas of the American West, hills, deserts, mountains, ancestral Pueblo structures, Capes says. We've asked Capes to take CNI on a special trip from Florida deep into the James Museum's American West. John Coleman, American, born 1949. Honeymoon at Crow Fair, 2014, bronze, 98 by 80 by 38 inches. Inspired by the native cultures and history, John Coleman has told remarkable stories through his sculptures and paintings since the 1990s. His detailed figurative works show extensive research, a deep respect for his subjects, and technical mastery of his medium. I included Coleman's art in this tour to represent the dozens of bronze sculptures throughout the museum, as well as the Cowboy Artists of America organization, of which he's a member. His art is displayed prominently, including this bronze in front of our waterfall on a custom plinth within a reflection pool. Here, a couple from the early 1900s participate in the annual Crow Fair Parade on the Crow Agency on Montana. They introduce themselves to their people for the first time as newlyweds, and the parasol gives shade from the summer sun. Coleman first had the idea for this sculpture when he purchased an antique parasol. Here, the trade item contrasts with the couple's traditional regalia. The Crow Fair, annually held in August since 1904, is a four-day celebration of Native culture with powwow, rodeo, and elaborate parade. It is one of the largest Native American events on the continent, and is organized by the Crow tribe. Charles M. Russell, American, 1864 to 1926, in the nick of time, circa 1896 to 1897, watercolor, 18 by 22 inches. Charlie Russell is known as a dynamic storyteller with his art. In The Nick of Time is a terrific example of one of his action scenes. The detailed wooded backdrop with sharp rocks and downed trees sets the stage for high drama between a frontiersman, a Native American, and a grizzly bear. Russell likely didn't witness this exact peril during his many adventures in the Montana wilderness, but his thorough rendering certainly makes the viewer wonder if he did. As a kid growing up in Missouri, Russell was fascinated by the Wild West and would see fur traders and explorers come through on their way to the frontier. The allure proved so great that he left school at 16 to work on a sheep ranch in Montana. From there, he cowboyed in the Judith Basin and eventually settled in Great Falls to a life of art, portraying his first-hand experiences. This painting is one of the oldest in the museum and on display in our Early West gallery. With the collection's focus on acquiring art by living artists to help support their careers, adding works by deceased Western art masters like Russell and Frederick Remington came just in the last decade as museum plans developed. We wanted to tell some of the earlier Western art stories and show work by pioneering artists that have influenced today's Western painters and sculptors. If our museum visitors are familiar with Western art, Charlie Russell is a name they likely know and whose influence they have certainly seen. Dave McGarry, American, 1958-2013. The Honor Dress, 2006. Bronze with patina and acrylic paint, 33x20x17 inches. Tom and Mary James have been dedicated patrons of the arts for decades, and over time they've developed close relationships with many artists. Dave McGarry was one of them, and before he passed away from cancer in 2013, close to 40 of his figurative sculptures of Native Americans had been acquired for the collection. McGarry's absolute understanding of anatomy, gesture, and weight is seen in his work, and he was a master of creating texture in bronze, thus making hide, hair, fabric, and beadwork look lifelike. He was one of the only bronze artists to add colorful paint to his sculptures, accentuating the detail. His respect for tribal culture, values, and spirituality rivaled his attention to artistic detail and earned the trust and confidence of his American Indian subjects to the point that McGarry was adopted into a Sioux family. Here, a warrior's widow honors the passing of her departed husband by wearing a rare, hand-painted ceremonial dress. The dress is adorned with special paintings symbolizing his war accomplishments. Standing strong with chin held high, she proudly carries his buffalo robe, war bonnet, and shield. The bonnet trails more than 100 golden eagle feathers. Paul Pletka, American, born 1946, Red Talkers, 1978, acrylic on linen, 72x112 inches. By one of Tom James' favorite artists, this dynamic painting's large size immediately draws the viewer into the scene. Here, Pletka, whose intense interest in indigenous costume, lore, and artifacts dates to childhood, lends his signature surreal interpretation to the Cheyenne Bull Society dance, traditionally performed by older warriors. As the men feverishly dance in a circle around three chaste girls who symbolize fertility, two of the warriors in the foreground are beginning a metamorphosis. At first glance, it appears the dancers are wearing bison headdresses, but Pletka shows them transforming into bison. Their skin is opening to reveal their personal medicine symbols, represented as green mice and honeybees, the embodiment of their power. Pletka is influenced by a variety of artistic movements and histories, from Gothic to Surrealist. Rooted in exhaustive research and fueled by his vivid imagination, his unique style is defined by rich symbolism and meticulous detail. "It's just me and the way I see things," Pletka says. His fascination with Native American cultures began as a child when his father showed him a collection of arrowheads. From that point on, he drew Native American subjects. Pletka's natural ability to draw was enhanced through study at Mesa College and Colorado State University. His lifelong consuming interest in indigenous cultures is reflected in his art. The James Collection includes 14 of his major paintings. Earl Biss, Native American, Crow, Chippewa, 1947 to 1998. Winter Sunrise, Circle of the Big Sky People, 1985. Oil on canvas, 40 by 82 inches. Tom and Mary James had amassed hundreds of works of art by the mid-1980s, but this painting is what started a passion for collecting Western art that eventually culminated in the James Museum. On a 1985 visit to Colorado, Tom first saw this Biss painting, freshly completed and still wet, in a gallery. He purchased it that day after meeting the artist. Today, approximately 30% of the art on display in the museum is by contemporary Native artists. With this scene, Biss transports us to winter in Montana, the home of his people. You can almost hear the wind whipping across the snowy plains. Notice how the sky takes on most of the canvas, a reference to this remote region known as Big Sky. The painting treatment of the snowy land and sky are quite similar, separated only by the dark horizon line and the beginnings of sunrise warmth. Shift your focus to the Indian riders on horses as they anticipate a new day. Their brightly patterned saddle blankets pop against the pale snow, an example of the artist's signature use of vivid colors. Biss was a key contributor to the contemporary Native American art movement of the 1960s and 70s. He studied under painter Fritz Scholder and sculptor Alan Hauser at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. Often inspired by Jackson Pollock's paint splatters and drips, Biss worked with spontaneity and thick, visible brushstrokes, hallmarks of abstract expressionism. His energetic scenes honor his native heritage as well as nature. Dan Norminga, Native American, Hopi, Tiwa, born 1950. Hopi Montage, number 17, 2008. Acrylic on canvas, 36 by 108 inches. A bold colorist, Dan Norminga's artistic themes center around his Hopi heritage and the land of his people. He incorporates elements and symbols in his culture using a stylized, abstracted approach. Tom and Mary James have followed Norminga's career since the 1980s, acquiring 30 of his paintings over the years and becoming friends. They've connected over art as well as music. Both Tom James and Norminga play multiple instruments. This painting of four related panels celebrates nature and the importance of water to the desert-dwelling Hopi people. Panel 1 represents the four colors of corn and the four cardinal directions. The black square represents the zenith, that which is above. The multicolored block represents Mater, that which is below. Panel 2 depicts the sacred spring from which life comes. Panel 3 pictures a flute player coming from the spring. He plays to bring rain and a good harvest. Panel 4 represents migration, with the bisecting line symbolizing the solstice. According to the Hopi religion, we are all in a constant state of migration. Mian Situ, Chinese American, born 1953. Toy peddler of DuPont Street, San Francisco, Chinatown, 1905-2011. Oil on canvas, 50 by 60 inches. I included this painting by Mian Situ to represent the Chinese American story in the development of the West. Even though they faced intense racial discrimination, Chinese immigrants played a major role in the settlement of California and as laborers in mines and on railroad lines. It's an often told story of American history, and for some museum visitors, this is an unexpected but fascinating subject in our galleries. Raised in the rural countryside of his native China, Situ is known for his magnificent portraiture and scenes of the daily lives of backcountry people. Inspired by his home country as well as Western historical themes and landscapes, he immigrated to Canada in 1988, eventually settling in Southern California in 1998 and becoming an award-winning painter at some of the West's most prestigious shows. This painting sets an idealized scene on San Francisco's DuPont Street in 1905. Just 1 year later, a devastating earthquake and subsequent fires would claim the lives of more than 3,000 people and destroy more than 80% of the city. Situ pays significant attention to historical details in this depiction, referencing photographs taken before the earthquake. A multicultural group of children and adults surround a toy peddler. The children are dressed in festive attire in celebration of the Lunar New Year. The balloons do not float, but are attached to a wooden stick, a nod to a time when before the availability of isolated helium. The street merchant's wares also include dolls and marbles, popular yet simple fun for children of the time. Though America's frontier was often the backdrop for strife and discrimination, the toy peddler provided joy for immigrant families. Jesse Monongye, Native American, Navajo, Hopi, born 1952. Monument Valley Pendant Necklace, 2015. 18-karat gold, coral, gaspite, lapis, turquoise. More than 100 objects handcrafted by 20th and 21st century Native American jewelers are on display in the museum's Jewel Box, an intimate and focused gallery experience that includes more than a dozen works by Jesse Monongye. Tom and Mary James have personally collected these works over many years of attending New Mexico's annual Santa Fe Indian Market and developing relationships with top exhibiting jewelers, including Monongye. Known for statement pieces created with meticulous designs and the finest materials, his work is a highlight of this portion of his collection. His Monument Valley pendant shows the artist's technical mastery of pictorial inlay. The miniature mosaic design is made of various types of coral, lapis, turquoise, and other semi-precious stones, skillfully cut to line up directly next to other cut stones. Monument Valley is famous for its isolated red mesas and buttes. Its iconic sandstone formations have provided the backdrop for many westerns, as early as 1939's Stagecoach with John Wayne. Located within the Navajo Nation in northern Arizona and southern Utah, the region has inspired artists for centuries. The specific landform depicted on this pendant is West Mitten Butte, so named because when viewed from the south, it looks like a giant mitten with a thumb on the east side. Daniel Smith, American, born 1954. Heavy Hitters, 2010. Acrylic on board, 30 by 48 inches. The bison rut is an annual spectacle that occurs during the heat of the summer, says Montana-based Daniel Smith. It is by far the best time to observe bison in action as they battle for dominance and vie for mates. The epitome of this occurrence is witnessing a full-blown fight between two mature bulls. Heavy Hitters is depicting the precursor to this main event. Of all North American wildlife, bison symbolize the American West like no other, and Smith is one of the great wildlife painters. The object of bison was a big factor in selecting this painting to represent the wildlife art in James's collection, though there are hundreds of fantastic works from which to choose. In his signature photorealistic style, Smith, one of the most accomplished interpreters of the genre, has created a compelling narrative that these beasts mean business. The focal point of the painting is the glaring eyes of the bison. The artist directs your gaze using an imaginary diagonal line from the rear hooves in the foreground upward to the curved tail in the background. Kicked up dust and an overcast sky contribute to the work's overall atmosphere of intensity. Yellowstone National Park is a terrific place to see the summer bison rut. If you aren't close to Wyoming, our museum in Florida has a terrific painting on view. Ed Mell, American, born 1942. High Desert Clouds, 2013. Oil on linen, 60 by 60 inches. Visitors to our museum often comment that they are surprised to see so many different styles of art in our galleries, not just realistic representations. And it's true that Western art is a genre is more about the content than any particular stylistic approach. This dynamic vista with towering clouds above jagged mountains is one of those unexpected paintings. Ed Mell's bold geometric style has influences from the early Southwest and New Mexican modernists. Raised in Arizona, Mell began his career as an illustrator in New York City. He grew tired of the fast-paced urban lifestyle and accepted an invitation to teach art on the Hopi Indian Reservation back in Arizona. Working with Hopi artists helped Mel appreciate the landscapes of his home state, and he decided to stay, relocating back to his hometown of Phoenix. In 1980, his perspective on painting was literally enlarged when Mel became friends with the helicopter pilot for a local NBC station. Subsequent helicopter rides gave him new material and a different vision of the Western landscape. His early works in oil tended toward angular minimalism, while today he paints in a more naturalistic style as well as an abstracted version of modernism, as seen here. Bill Schenck, American, born 1947. Oh, you wanted to see my guns? 1991, oil on canvas, 53 by 59 inches. Based in Santa Fe, Billy Schenck celebrates Western mystique with a bit of whimsy in his paintings. From his series of strong and sassy cowgirls, this large, colorful portrait gives a nod to pop art. With his distinctive painting approach of laying colors side by side with no blending, Schenck shows his sophisticated understanding of hue. Notice the surpassing colors he uses in the sky to depict the late-day sun and how he contrasts light and shadow on the girl's face. He is heavily influenced by cinematic imagery, Western films in particular, interpreting them in a flat, reductive style. This Western pop painting is another potentially unexpected work of art for museum visitors, and quite a popular one in our New West Gallery. Schenck visited the James Museum in 2019 for our first anniversary celebration, and I got a chance to interview him about his paintings in the James Collection, 13 in all. For this portrait, he engaged a model he met in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. They worked together regularly for more than a decade, and some of Schenck's most eye-catching images include her. Tammy Garcia, Native American, Santa Clara Pueblo, born 1969. Redware Pot, 2014. Clay and turquoise, 9 by 12 by 12 inches. Tammy Garcia is one of my favorite artists featured in the museum. She creates work that bridges the gap between traditional and modern. Her distinctive style includes deeply carved images and geometric forms that often reference her Santa Clara Pueblo roots. The women in Garcia's family have excelled at poetry since the 1800s, and she continues the rich tradition as one of the best Pueblo potters working today. Her carved vessels have highly polished designs for a definite contrast in color and sheen. In this particular pot, Garcia has added channels of cylindrical turquoise beads. Though one-of-a-kind poetry was Garcia's first passion, the meticulous process was time-consuming, and her output was limited. To satisfy collector demand, she became a master in the medium of bronze, so she could create art in editions. In the museum, her pot and bronzes are displayed side by side, demonstrating that her style transcends media. Garcia also has experimented with stainless steel, glass, and jewelry making, continually challenging herself as an artist and pushing boundaries in contemporary poetry.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1. Recording Library of West Texas produces weekly podcasts in association with Centers. Join Centers' Dr. Christy Edwards and licensed therapist Melanie Seitz, along with your host, Recording Library's Executive Director, Bailey Hennis, as they feature guests and discuss how to cope in the age of COVID-19. These programs present information about mental health and include tips on dealing with anxiety, isolation, worry, and more. Topics include mental exercises you can practice to become calm and relaxed, ideas on things to do during this time, information specific to seniors, and other related topics. The Center's COVID-19 podcasts, Tuesdays at 11 a.m., Wednesdays at 7 p.m., and Fridays at 5 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. You can also access these podcasts on demand at centerstx.org.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 90 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 80s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hachette Audio presents The Last Trial, written by Scott Turow, read by John Bedford Lloyd.
Now, Mr. Sullivan, if any further matter arises where I think it would inform the court to hear from Ms. Hartung's representatives, I will call on you. Otherwise, refrain from interrupting again in any way. Ms. Hartung, the question was whether you have the written waivers you testified about with you. Do I take it that they are in Mr.